Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. Over 700 are killed in a stampede near Mecca. At least 717 people have been killed, hundreds injured in a stampede at the annual Hajj pilgrimage. That, according to Saudi authorities, the crush occurred in Mina, a large valley about 5 kilometers from the holy city of Mecca that has been the site of Hajj stampedes over the past years. Mina is where pilgrims carry out a symbolic stoning of the devil by throwing pebbles against 3 stone walls. It also houses more than 160,000 tents where pilgrims spend the night during the pilgrimage. The Saudi Civil Defense Directorate earlier said at least 450 other pilgrims were injured in the stampede in Mina. It was not immediately clear if some of those previously listed as injured were included in the rising death tolls. Amateur video shared on social media showed a horrific scene with scores of bodies, the men dressed in the simple terry cloth garments worn during Hajj, lying in crushed wheelchairs and water bottles along a sunbaked street. 2 suicide bombers attacked a mosque in Yemen's capital Thursday, killing at least 25 people attending prayers at the start of the Eid al-Adha holiday. The blast in Sana'a hit a mosque run by the Shiite Houthi group that seized control of the city a year ago. Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet with U.S. President Barack Obama in New York City Monday. A Kremlin spokesman told journalists that Putin will meet with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and then with Obama later in the day. The 3 leaders are among the many who will be in New York next week to attend this year's session of the UN General Assembly. Putin will also address the assembly on Monday. This is VOA News. Pope Francis called on the U.S. Congress and the American people to set aside divisions and renew a spirit of fraternity and solidarity, cooperating generously for the common good. The Roman Catholic Church leader, the first pope ever to address the full U.S. Congress, was warmly applauded throughout his speech of nearly 50 minutes Thursday at the U.S. Capitol building. His message was broadcast throughout the nation and showed on huge video screens outside the heavily guarded center of American lawmaking. The rare joint meeting of Congress that Francis addressed brought together all members of both the House and Senate, plus the judges of the Supreme Court, the Vice President, Joe Biden, members of President Obama's cabinet, and key military leaders. The full array of the American governmental establishment, the same gathering that a sitting president addresses for the annual State of the Union message. Pope Francis, as expected, called for action against dangers to our planet posed by economic injustice and climate change.
We need a conversation which includes everyone, since the environmental challenge we are undergoing and its human roots concern and affect us all.
Pope Francis also touched on other sensitive issues in the U.S., including the Middle East refugee crisis and the excesses of capitalism. Later Thursday, the Pope will travel to New York City, where he will celebrate Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, address the UN General Assembly on Friday, and Saturday he'll travel to Philadelphia for this weekend's Vatican-sponsored World Meeting of Families. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has told her country's 16 state governors that Europe's agreement on a quota plan to accommodate 120,000 migrants is a sign of unity, but cautioned that it is only a first step. She said in a meeting in Berlin Thursday that Europe is still very far from where it needs to be in dealing with the situation. She said the violence in Syria that caused the displacement of so many people can only be resolved with the help from the United States, Russia, and the Middle East. The European Council President Donald Tusk, after the EU leaders agreed to give over $1 billion to international aid agency helping refugees, made an announcement after an emergency summit in Brussels ended early Thursday.
It is clear that the greatest tide of refugees and migrants is yet to come. Therefore, we need to correct the policy of open doors and windows. Now the focus should be on the proper protection of our external borders and on external assistance to refugees and the countries in our neighborhood.
I'm Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Saudi officials are saying that over 700 pilgrims died and more than 800 were injured Thursday in a stampede along the route leading to the ritual stoning of the devil. Witnesses say the stampede took place along a narrow street in the region of Mina.
That's Edward Uranian reporting from Cairo. Details next.
Also in the news, Pope Francis addressed a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today, and the Nigerian military has banned all traffic from the streets of Borno state towns during the two-day celebration of the Muslim holiday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda in our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Saudi officials are saying that over 700 pilgrims died and more than 800 were injured today in a stampede along the route leading to the ritual stoning of the devil. Witnesses say the stampede took place along a narrow street in the region of Mina, as Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Amateur video showed a crowd of hundreds of pilgrims being bowled over and crushed in a stampede on a narrow road alongside rows of tents housing visitors to the annual Hajj. Health Minister Khalid Fala told journalists the stampede occurred when pilgrims tried to go against the crowd along a narrow road, ignoring time restrictions for movement in each direction. He vowed that a quick investigation would take place to assess what happened. Saudi TV reported that the governor of Mecca, Prince Khalid Al Faisal, had gone to the site of the stampede to oversee rescue operations. The prince told the TV that many African pilgrims were caught in the crush. The stampede took place as thousands of pilgrims headed to the ritual stoning of the devil ceremony inside Mecca. A survivor of the stampede explained that he was caught in an unusually heavy crowd and that it became impossible to move in either direction. He says that people were crushed to death in front of him, but that he was lucky and was taken to the hospital. In a final ritual Thursday, the Imam of Mecca's Grand Mosque told the throngs of pilgrims gathered inside the colossal structure to unite and avoid dissension and ungodly behavior. Most pilgrims will sacrifice an animal in a symbolic gesture to conclude their participation in the event. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Nigerian military has banned all traffic from the streets of Borno state towns during a two-day celebration of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Banned vehicles include all cars, trucks, bicycles, horses, donkeys, and camels. A military spokesman says the ban is designed to help ensure security. The move comes shortly after 117 people died in the state capital, Maiduguri, in a series of suicide bombings attributed to Boko Haram militants. President Muhammadu Buhari has given his new military high command until early November to end the rebellion. The violence has claimed at least 17,000 lives and made more than 2 million homeless in 6 years.
Pope Francis addressed a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today. He thanked representatives, senators, and others for the opportunity to speak in the land of the free and home of the brave. The Pope said a political society endures when it seeks as a vocation to satisfy common needs by stimulating the growth of all its members, especially those in situations of greater vulnerability or risk.
All of us are quiet. Aware of and deeply worried by the disturbing social and political situation of the world today. Our world is increasingly a place of violent conflict, hatred, and brutal atrocities, committed even in the name of God and of religion. We know that no religion is immune from forms of individual delusion or ideological extremism. This means that we must be specially attentive to every type of fundamentalism, whether religious or of any other kind. A delicate balance is required to combat violence perpetrated in the name of a religion, an ideology, or an economic system, while also safeguarding religious freedom, intellectual freedom, and individual freedoms. But there is another temptation which we must specially guard against. The simplistic reductionism which sees only good or evil, or if you will, the righteous and sinners. The contemporary world, with its open wounds, which affect so many of our brothers and sisters, demands that we confront every form of polarization, which would divide it into these two camps.
Francis also spoke of the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis gripping Europe and alluded to the immigration debate here in the United States.
Our world is facing a refugee crisis of a magnitude not seen since the Second World War. This presents us with great challenges and many hard decisions. On this continent, too, thousands of persons are led to travel north in search of a better life for themselves and for their loved ones, in search of greater opportunity. It is not what we want for our own children. We must not be taken aback by the numbers, but rather view them as persons, seeing their faces and listening to their stories, trying to respond as best we can to their situation, to respond in a way which is always human, just, and fraternal. We need to avoid a common temptation nigh awaits, to discard whatever proves troublesome. Let us remember the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
France has also said the United States and Congress have an important role to play in protecting the environment against deterioration caused by human activity. He said he supports U.S. bishops in their call to abolish the death penalty in the United States. He said that a just and necessary punishment must never exclude the dimension of hope and the goal of rehabilitation. Pope Francis is scheduled to leave Washington, D.C. at 20 UTC and arrive in New York City about an hour later. He'll spend much of tomorrow there and travel to Philadelphia Saturday morning. The Pope leaves for Rome Sunday night.
The day after a majority of European Union leaders approved distribution of more than 120,000 migrants, German Chancellor Angela Merkel warns that a solution to the migrant crisis is far from over. She says the crisis will shape Europe in the long term. European Council President Donald Tusk warns the greatest tide of refugees and migrants is yet to come. He says there could be millions of refugees. The crisis will be back on the agenda at the next meeting of EU presidents and prime ministers, scheduled for October 15th and 16th in Brussels. Meanwhile, the flow continues unabated. Hungary reports a record number yesterday, an estimated 10,000 migrants and refugees entering from Croatia. In a single hour today, about 1,200 arrived on the Greek island of Lesbos. It is the second day of a sharp rise in arrivals from Turkey. And police say one young migrant, believed to be from Sudan or Eritrea, was found dead in the Channel Tunnel. About a dozen migrants have died trying to reach Britain through the tunnel.
The UN World Food Programme is playing a major role in the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis. Most of those fleeing to Europe are from Syria, where the WFP says conditions continue to deteriorate. The agency is assisting millions of people within Syria and many others who fled to neighboring countries. In Cairo, Abir Atefa is the World Food Programme's senior spokeswoman for the Middle East and North Africa region. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the WFP's humanitarian operations during the migrant and refugee crisis.
Well, over the last 5 years, the World Food Program has been working to feed over 6 million people displaced by the conflict in Syria. That includes around 4 million people who are uprooted and displaced inside Syria, in addition to another 1.8 million people who fled Syria and became refugees in the neighboring countries. Families receive consistently monthly food baskets inside Syria that include the staple food commodities, that's rice, wheat flour, vegetable oil, canned food, the basic food items. In the neighboring countries, refugees receive food vouchers. Some of these vouchers are actually electronic cards, whereby they go to local shops in the neighborhood where they live, and they can redeem these vouchers against food items from supermarkets, and this allows them to get access to fresh food, like, you know, fresh dairy products or fruits and vegetables.
Many UN agencies have had the same complaint recently that they do not have enough funding. What about your funding levels?
It's been an ongoing program for the last 4 years, consistently giving refugees access to food every month, and we haven't missed a month. But funding has been extremely difficult since the beginning of the year, which has forced us to reduce the value of our assistance, that now refugees in the neighboring countries are only getting half of what they used to receive. And this basically translates into less than 50 cents a day for a refugee to put food on the table for himself or herself. And also for the families inside Syria, the size and the quantities of the food has been reduced by around 25%. So people are receiving definitely less food.
So how much more money do you need to restore rations to their previous levels?
In order for us to restore these rations to previous levels and to also add these people that we had to cut off from our assistance this month, we need around $237 million US dollars from now until the end of December. And it's been a difficult challenge for the World Food Program because it's been hand-to-mouth operation. So what happens is that, you know, we receive funding that would allow us to go for a month or two. And then after 2 months, we crash again. And what we need is predictable and sustainable form of funding. This crisis is not going away. And until a political solution is found, the needs are still there and they need to be met.
Abir Atefa is the World Food Programme's senior spokeswoman for the Middle East and North Africa region. From Cairo, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
World attention has focused in recent weeks on the thousands of Syrian refugees trying to reach peace and safety in Europe. But several refugee crises, some decades old, continue in sub-Saharan Africa. Millions seek refuge from conflict in Somalia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and other troubled spots. Some refugees have been living in camps as long as 20 years. Determining the legal status of refugee families and getting them resettled in the United States is a complex process. To find out more about how that's done, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with William Honey of Church World Service, a New York-based NGO that helps process and resettle refugees from over 35 sub-Saharan nations.
The interviews that we do with refugees destined for the United States is actually quite extensive. We have several different rounds of interviews where we ask them about who they are, why they fled, and they really have to be able to prove that they're a refugee under the 1951 Refugee Convention and also under U.S. law. All the refugees that we dealt with in sub-Saharan Africa are ones that had already fled their country of origin, whether that be Somalia, Congo, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and now they're in their country of asylum. That is usually either Kenya, Ethiopia, or elsewhere around sub-Saharan Africa. We processed in about 35 different countries this last year, so that means going out on location to interview refugees, whether in camps or urban locations, basically from coast to coast on the continent.
So what you do is you ease their passage to the United States to be absorbed?
Yeah, so the process to come to the United States involves lots of different steps and interviews. It involves background checks, it involves medical checks, and eventually cultural orientation before they arrive in the United States. And that last stage is teaching them about, you know, what's life going to be like in the United States, basic things like grocery shopping, what are bathrooms like. You know, a lot of times those are different over in sub-Saharan Africa. So being able to kind of give people at least the basics before they arrive so that they can have a better start when they get here to the U.S. Many of the refugees coming from sub-Saharan Africa have never been on an airplane. So in our offices over in Kenya, we actually have real-life models of airline seats that have been donated by airlines to teach, you know, refugees how to use a seatbelt on an airline, what to do in the seat, about the signs that they're going to experience on the airline, all those different types of things to kind of prepare them for what for many of them will be 14, 15 hours straight in an airplane. Also related to the food that they're going to try, the different things that they're going to eat, and how to help manage their children and their relatives in this process of, you know, transiting through airports, going through Europe. You know, it's all just a very big process that many of them have never experienced before.
I understand from what you're saying that there's lots of very concrete, practical things to discuss. But of course, many of these people are extremely traumatized. I'm wondering if there's any kind of self-care tips that you give people more than simply referring them to other people down the road.
Well, one of the things I think that helps with refugees when they arrive to the United States is really being able to make friends and connect with local communities. So we try to partner refugees when they arrive in the United States with local volunteers, with local places of worship. Making a friend in the United States is the easiest and quickest way, one, to learn English, and two, to kind of learn more about the communities that they're resettling in and to really integrate in a way that is going to help in the long run. Many of the refugees have spent years in a camp. On average, about 20 years are spent in camp life before they're resettled to the United States. It's really a huge amount of time. And so just way of life in a camp can be traumatizing in itself.
Are there any kind of sort of homegrown African traditions that you can use to help them understand and relate to their own situation?
Yeah, I think the concept of African hospitality is certainly key in refugees understanding what life is going to be like in the United States. I think many people from Africa can completely understand the relationships, especially the family relationships that go on, the need to support relatives, the need to care for the elderly, the need to kind of be a family unit and to really everybody to pitch in when they arrive in the United States. So that's one of the things that we really look for, especially with families from Africa, is that they understand this concept of unity, of families kind of getting together and sharing. From my time speaking with different refugees in the camps, one of their biggest you know, hopes and dreams is actually to find a job. A lot of them, you know, have been not able to work for years. One, because they're not provided work visas in the camps. They're only allowed to, you know, find temporary employment, whether that's pushing a wheelbarrow, whether it's selling things in a local shop. But it's very temporary work, and it doesn't pay very well. And so really for them to be able to come to the United States and find a job and be able to, you know, provide for their families and be self-sufficient within a short amount of time, that's really one of the greatest things for refugees, and it really provides them, you know, the dignity, you know, and just the family unity that they're looking for.
You really love this kind of work, don't you?
Absolutely. Definitely love this kind of work. So seeing refugees come in nowadays, it warms my heart. It makes me feel proud of the work that we're doing, proud of the work that the United States is part of, and I hope that we can increase it even more in the future.
That's William Honey, spokesman for the Church World Service. He spoke with the VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
A new report finds most natural disasters in 2014 were climate-related. In its 2015 World Disasters Report, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies warns climate change will lead to an increase in the frequency and severity of future hazards. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Compared to previous years, 2014 in many ways was a statistically better year in regard to global disasters. For example, the World Disasters Report cites 317 disasters worldwide, the lowest number of the decade, or 17% below the average. Lead editor of the report, Mo Hamza, says nearly 107 million people were affected by these disasters. He acknowledges this is a relative increase on the previous year.
But this number is still well below the highest number of disasters in the last decade, which occurred in 2005, when a total of 810 disasters were reported. In 2014, disasters caused 8,186 deaths worldwide. Nevertheless, the mortality level was almost 90% lower than the decade's average.
Asia is the most disaster-prone region in the world. The report finds 48% of all disasters occurred in Asia in 2014. More than 85% of those killed and affected globally also were in Asia. The report ranks China as the world's most disaster-affected country in the world, noting 731 people were killed in an earthquake in August 2014. It says drought, storms, and flooding affected more than 58 million people in China. Hamza tells VOA 87% of global disasters were climate-related, continuing a 20-year trend of climate-related disasters.
There is no doubt that extreme events impacted by climate change in terms of frequency and magnitude, that's no longer in doubt. But what matters as much is how vulnerable populations are in the hotspots, and where these, in low-lying deltas and in coastal zones, for example.
The report shows floods and landslides accounted for nearly half of all natural disasters in 2014 and were responsible for 63% of disaster-affected deaths. It cites floods in India, Pakistan, and the Balkans among the most severe. It notes the impact of drought, which affected 39% of all people last year, is often overlooked by the more visually dramatic floods. Yet, it says this forgotten, silent disaster severely affects the economies of millions of people, especially in the Sahel region of Africa. In a last bit of relative good news, the report estimates economic losses in 2014 at $99.2 billion, well below the annual average of $147 billion seen during the past 10 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Saudi officials are saying that over 700 pilgrims died and more than 800 were injured today in a stampede. Pope Francis addressed a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today. And the Nigerian military bans all traffic from the streets of Borno state towns during the two-day celebration of the Muslim holiday. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda and, in our feature segment, a conversation with one of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs, Noah Samara. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with African athletics.
Kim, our starting line on the sunny side of sports is African athletics. Long distance runners from neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia have dominated the annual BMW Berlin Marathon. And that's expected to be the case again Sunday when the race is run for the 42nd time in the German capital. We have to go back to 1998 to find an athlete not from Kenya or Ethiopia who won the overall title in Berlin. The Brazilian Ronaldo da Costa won that year in a then world record, 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 5 seconds. Since then, 8 more world records have been set in Berlin, one of the fastest marathon courses in the world. Last year in Berlin, Kenya's Dennis Kimeto set a new world record of 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. Kimeto is not running in the German capital Sunday, but there's once again top talent from Kenya and Ethiopia who will be competing. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with one of Kenya's leading contenders in the women's race. Here's Andy.
We're about to have a chat with Gladys Chirono, who is one of the hot favorites for the BMW Berlin Marathon this Sunday. Gladys had a fantastic 2015. She was injured last year, supposed to have been running here in Berlin, but she had to make her debut, well, had to, in Dubai in January, around 2 hours, 20 minutes, and 3 seconds, finishing only 1 second behind the Ethiopian Aselefek Mergia. Gladys, are you feeling sharp for Sunday? I know it's only your second marathon, but you really have a great pedigree.
Yes, I'm happy because now I'm okay. I've trained very well, and I know I will run my personal best.
Does it feel a bit funny, because in a sense, to be here when originally you thought you were going to be here a year ago and running your debut in Berlin?
This year, last year, I was supposed to be here, but I was injured. But this time, everything is okay. Yes.
It looks, well, you tell me, as if you've had just about a perfect build-up for this marathon, because you had that great debut in the marathon in Dubai in January. You've run personal bests at 10K on the road and half marathon. Just tell me, has it been perfect or not?
Yes, this is perfect. I have trained very well. I know this race is a faster course, and I hope everything will be okay. I will run my best.
Looking at the women's field, and indeed I think it's true of the men's, it's very competitive. It's not all about one runner. Can he or she break a record? Are you aware of that, you know, just how strong the women's field is?
I don't know, because we have a strong women team, and they have run a lot of marathons than me, so I can't say anything now. Let's see on that day.
You know, great runners like Haile Gebrselassie and Paul Tergat have said that they had to learn about the marathon. This will be your second one only. Do you feel you're still learning despite your great debut?
Yeah, maybe we don't know, but this course we have seen men always breaking records. No ladies have been. Maybe it will be our time. We will do so.
You're just 3 seconds outside breaking 2:20. Well, let's say 4 to be mathematically correct. Is that an incentive, or is it more a case of, well, the victory above all?
Yes, I will try my best to run good. Yes, and I will do in the race also.
Well, there you are from Gladys Chirona, one of indeed the favourites, but there are quite a few of them in the women's field at the BMW Berlin Marathon 2015. Race day is Sunday. Thank you, Gladys.
Thank you very much.
One of Uganda's top marathon runners has been honored. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma has that story as well as other sports news.
Ugandan distance runner Solomon Mutai was crowned the Uganda Sports Press Association USPA Personality of the Month for August in Kampala, Uganda. Mutai earned the accolade after clinching a bronze medal in men's marathon on the opening day of the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China last month. In volleyball, Africa's campaign at the World Men's Volleyball Championships ended on a sour note as Iran dismissed Egypt in straight sets and Canada beat Tunisia in a similar fashion in Tokyo, Japan on Wednesday. However, Egypt has something to cheer as Ahmed Abdelhay was named the tournament's top scorer with 230 points and Badawi Mohamed Monim was named the best receiver with 58.62%. The champions United States of America and runners-up Italy qualify for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics while Poland are bronze medalists.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Turning to rugby, Namibia face a baptism of fire when they challenge world champions New Zealand in their opening match of their campaign at the Rugby World Cup at the Olympic Stadium in London, England, today, Thursday. The Namibians and South Africa are the only teams from Africa at the 20-nation contest. In South Africa, African champions South Africa are seeded in Group A for the Africa Women's Olympic Rugby Sevens qualifier due to start in Johannesburg on Saturday. Namibia, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Zambia are also in Group A. Kenya is seeded in Group B, which also features Botswana, Madagascar, Senegal, and Tunisia. The top three teams at the two-day contest stand the best chance of playing at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics next year.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. As Mark Ouma mentioned, Namibia faces a baptism of fire Thursday evening when they play reigning title holder New Zealand at Olympic Stadium in London at the Rugby World Cup. The All Blacks of New Zealand began their campaign for a third world title with a 26-16 victory over Argentina at Wembley Stadium in London. This will be Namibia's first match at the 20-team tournament. New Zealand's head coach, Steve Hansen, says the All Blacks can't make the mistake of overlooking the Namibians.
We can't just assume that Namibia are going to lie down, because they won't. You know, the World Cup's already shown that in previous World Cups, and this one's already shown it. So They'll be proud men, and they'll come out and give it everything they've got, and they'll ask questions of us for sure.
Meanwhile, South African rugby fans have been asking questions for sure after their team's opening 34-32 loss to Japan, a result that's been described as the biggest upset in Rugby World Cup history. The Springboks of South Africa, two-time world champions, will try to bounce back Saturday when they play Samoa in Birmingham, England. South Africa's head coach, Heineke Meyer, is vowing the Springboks can still lift the cup. Here's how he describes the stunning loss to the Japanese.
I mean, it's just unacceptable. We Springboks, by saying that, that doesn't mean you've got a right just to win. And I think that's what we as players sometimes forget. The other countries, like I said numerous times, and Turi warned us, and Skog warned us, that the Japanese play good rugby. We don't see them, but we study them. And I said to the team, it's going to be a hell of a tough game. So we as South Africans have to respect the rest of the world. But by saying that, I really still believe that we can win the World Cup. I know I'm always been a positive person, and I've been knocked out a few times in my life, and mostly it's come back. So I still believe we can do it. But the players have to put up their hands, and the coaching staff, and all of us. It's just not good enough. And if we stand together as a 23, play like I know we can play, play to our strengths, and have the mental toughness, back our captain, I know we can still do it. And you know, it'll be one of the best turnarounds in the world, but it's not going to be easy.
South Africa's national rugby coach, Heineke Meyer, speaking in Birmingham, England. That's where the Springboks of South Africa face Samoa on Saturday at the Rugby World Cup. In Rugby World Cup results Wednesday, the two-time world champion Wallabies of Australia kicked off their campaign with a 28-13 victory over Fiji in Cardiff, Wales. Scotland defeated Japan 45-10 in Gloucester, England. And France moved to the top of the table in Pool D. The French beat Romania 38-11 at Olympic Stadium in London. It was the second consecutive victory for the French. I encourage our VOA listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you check out my Facebook page today, Thursday, you'll see a wonderful photo of 105-year-old Hideki Miyazaki, who this week broke his own record as the oldest competitive sprinter at a meet in Kyoto, Japan. Hideki is shown doing his best imitation of Usain Bolt's lightning bolt pose, except Hideki likes to call it the golden boat pose. Hideki clocked 42.22 seconds for 100 meters, about 8 seconds off his personal record. According to Guinness World Records, Japan's golden bolt didn't start running until he was well into his 90s. Earlier this week, Japan celebrated Respect for the Aged Day. The Japanese government says it has 60,000 people who are over the age of 100. Keep running, Hideki! Keep running at 105. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Yes, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a conversation with one of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs, Noha Samara. And next, Zimbabwe's opposition versus President Robert Mugabe. But first, some music. Here is Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Yara tu afite turabuzo kuru batatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inka ziwacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa nanjye umuto muri bo maze kuba umugabo udaterwa kundi mwana wa shenge
Manny Martin, Afro Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. One of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs is Noha Samara, the chairman and CEO of Yasmi USA. The company manufactures the tablet called Odyssey that is used in schools in rural, low-income, and remote areas in the world. The tablet relies on satellites instead of the internet to reach students with curricular and software tools for learning and teaching. With the solar-charged tablet, students can participate in live classrooms from home. Samara is also the former chief executive officer of WorldSpace, the world's first operating satellite radio network that serves Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. I spoke to Samara recently about his career and the use of technology in education. In today's segment, Mr. Samara talks about his interaction with world leaders and gives young entrepreneurs some advice.
I think particularly in the earlier days of WorldSpace, starting that company, I was pretty young. And so meeting people and meeting world leaders in either different fields or national leaders was always something to look forward to. But over time, you look back and you start saying, you know, which meant something and which did not. I think probably the one person that both influenced me and spoke to my experience as an African on a journey to solving purely African problems was President Mandela. And that was just a fascinating experience, knowing him over a period of time, meeting him several times, spending time with him. And at one point, we built a school together, he and I, in a township outside of Soweto called Freedom Park. So that itself, just the experience of his dedication, his realness, he was a very real person in the sense of genuine, not just, you know, he less a politician, more a leader, as what you might expect a leader to be in the etymological sense of the word.
Being a very successful entrepreneur yourself, any advice on steps young people can take to starting a successful business?
It's hard to say because businesses, you know, successful businesses are as varied as the human race. I think the one advice I would give is solve a problem rather than run a business. If you solve a problem, and the bigger the problem you're solving, the bigger your market. You know, at the end of the day, the best businesses solve somebody's problem. You know, I need to be in contact with people while I'm on the move. So somebody comes up with the cell phone idea or telephony on the move. You know, I need to have information on my fingertips. Boom, comes Google. You know, so I think the best way, the best place to start in becoming a very good entrepreneur is to figure out something that attracts you and something that solves somebody's problem. Solve somebody's problem is important because if you're gonna spend an hour figuring out something and it pays you $1 million, or you spend an hour figuring out something and it pays you $20 million, you know, it's best to spend it on that thing which, you know, delivers the bigger, from a business point of view, the bigger return on your investment. But it's equally important to also remember that you need to be interested in what you're doing. When I started WorldSpace, I was 32 years old, and there was at the time no one that looked like me launching satellites. So I used to go to work at 3 o'clock in the morning, work from 3 o'clock until 7, 8, 9, and when people come in, and then I start my second day. But I never felt tired, because I really felt like my life was on a mission. I had a mission, and I wanted to solve this problem as much as possible. The love that you have for the thing you're doing puts you in that state of flow. There is an African saying, if you want your dreams to come true, don't go to sleep.
That was Ethiopian entrepreneur Noah Samara. He spoke to me recently from our VOA studios in Washington.
Zimbabwe's opposition has petitioned the Speaker of Parliament over alleged death threats received by 7 of its lawmakers. The members of Parliament were warned not to heckle or boo Mr. Mugabe in Parliament last week. The Media Institute of Southern Africa says Mr. Mugabe's remarks also threatened the independent media for publishing stories alleging he is scared to run against his former Vice President Joyce Mujuru. She was ousted from the ruling party in December. Thomas Tirapasi reports.
MDCT spokesperson Obed Gutu told a news conference at his party's Harvest House headquarters that the opposition was very disturbed by the threats received by some of his party's legislators on their mobile phones just before President Robert Mugabe read a wrong speech to officially open the third session of Zimbabwe's 8th parliament. Gutu said his party suspected that the state was responsible for the alleged threats, adding that the MDCT has since written a letter to Mudenda expressing its dismay over the issue.
And it is wholly improper and uncalled for the Speaker of Parliament to purport to muzzle the freedom of our parliamentarians in the exercise of their oversight role.
This comes after Mudenda yesterday ordered opposition lawmakers not to echo President Mugabe, who they embarrassed when he presented his State of the Nation address 3 weeks ago. Gutu told reporters that the affected legislators were now living in fear of their lives following the threats and called on Mudenda to take action.
If you look at the Constitution of Zimbabwe, the Speaker of Parliament is actually the head of Parliament. So it is actually very insulting for Advocate Jacob Mudenda, the Honorable Speaker of Parliament, to say to our individual members of Parliament, go and report to the police, because it should be his office, because Parliament is an institution. So for him to trivialize these threats and say, go and report, with respect, you are not happy, and we actually stated that in the letter.
Police spokesperson, Senior Assistant Commissioner Cherit Charamba said they have not yet received a complaint on the matter, but Gutu said the Speaker of Parliament should apologize and give a written guarantee that the opposition lawmakers shall not be harmed during the execution of their duties, both inside and outside the August House. The opposition said the death threats against its lawmakers were caught a chilling reminder of the deteriorating security situation in the country following the abduction and subsequent disappearance of pro-democracy activist Itai Dzamara by suspected state agents. Inside Parliament, MDCT Chief Whip Innocent Gonese asked the Parliament to set up a special parliamentary committee to look into the threats issued to some of his party's lawmakers. However, Mudenda referred the matter to Parliament's Standing Rules and Orders Committee, which deals with such matters. An independent political analyst, Marvin Mukudu, noted that democracy is now at risk in Zimbabwe.
The attack mainly on MPs represents an attack directly of the people, considering that a member of parliament represents the people who elected them to be in parliament to articulate their views and aspirations.
MDCT legislators heckled Mr. Mugabe during his State of the Nation address when he told parliamentarians that the country's economy was showing great signs of recovery. On the contrary, the opposition and some economists say the nation's economy is on a downward trend. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Tune in to VOA
feature programs on your radio and on the internet. We bring you news about Africa and the world 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. News, talk shows, sports, music, everything you want to hear. Available on the radio and the web on The Voice of America. Find the VOA program guide at www.voanews.com and check local listings for stations near you that carry VOA programming.
The latest news on the political crisis in Ivory Coast. VOA Abidjan listeners can tune to FM 99.0 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The latest on Ivory Coast in French and English on FM 99.0 in Abidjan.